This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, PNG's overcrowded hospital morgue has caused a stir online, but authorities say it's community members not picking up their relatives' bodies from the hospital at the heart of the problem.
Some of these bodies eventually become unclaimed by relatives for whatever reason, and they end up accumulating and causing this strain on the very limited capacity we have at the morgue.
And Fiji's opposition leader Frank Bainimarama has launched another scathing attack on the new government.
They're extremely belligerent and even provocative and making all sorts of claims about the new government breaching the constitution that are false and misleading.
So what does all of that tell us about the inner workings of Fiji's new opposition? We'll speak to our reporter on the ground later in the show. And the kava export market is growing in the Pacific, but what are foreigners looking for in the plant? We'll speak to an expert on the business of marketing of kava to foreign countries. All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, 3 years since the COVID-19 pandemic began, one of the world's largest countries is finally lifting its international travel restrictions. China has done an extraordinary about-turn on its zero-COVID policy, now abandoning strict quarantine requirements for inbound travelers. It means Chinese tourists can return to the Pacific very soon, and for some countries, that's exciting news. Marion Farr with this report.
A Pacific getaway like no other. That's what Kiribati is marketing to one of the world's most significant tourist populations.
What we offer to the Chinese traveller is really an alternative to mainstream travel into other Pacific Island destinations.
3 years since the global pandemic was first declared, China is finally set to relax its international travel restrictions. From the 8th of January, Chinese citizens will be able to book holidays overseas without having to quarantine in a hotel when they return home. Petero Manifalau, CEO of the Tourism Authority of Kiribati, wants his country to be their destination of choice.
The opportunity to experience a whole different world, where culture and community is really at the heart of who we are as a destination.
For him, it's been a long wait. Kiribati secured official Chinese government approval as a tourist destination in 2019, just before the COVID-19 pandemic hit.
What it means for us as a destination is that, you know, we're on a recommended list of destinations for Chinese travellers, so that in itself is a welcome accolade.
But the country hasn't seen the fruits of that recognition just yet.
The borders closing in 2020, we have not really seen or benefited from that recognition. So we're looking forward to when China does open its outbound travel market for us to explore the opportunities out from there.
Chinese tourism is highly lucrative, with the country's overseas visitors spending a massive $127 billion on travel in 2019. When tourism resumes, Kiribati will have to compete with other Pacific countries also looking for a slice of that pie.
When you look at China, it's been consistently a good market for Fiji.
Brent Hill is the CEO of Tourism Fiji. He says prior to the pandemic, China was the fifth largest market for the country.
China was a really strong market. They travelled at different times of the year, which was great. And they also spent, the spend per tourist from China was really good as well. So, yeah, certainly from our perspective, it's one that we've been looking forward to welcoming back again.
It's also good news for students and teachers like Setope So'o'a Emalalagi, who teaches Samoan language at the Beijing Foreign Studies University in China.
It's been very challenging for myself personally, because when I left China, it was just on the eve of the outbreak of COVID.
He went home to New Zealand for a holiday in 2019 and hasn't been able to return to China since then.
The news that China is opening up come January 8th, absolutely exciting. I can't wait to get back to Beijing.
For him, it means being able to continue important work.
I'm teaching Samoan language. It's the first time in Chinese history, in their 5,000-year history, that they're learning Samoan language. And so it's really opened up the eyes of students in China to what the Pacific is.
But around the globe, there are some concerns about the return of Chinese international travel. The global superpower is experiencing its biggest COVID-19 wave yet, and that has prompted some countries to place restrictions on Chinese visitors. Australia, the UK and the US all require people travelling from China to return a negative COVID-19 test before departure. The Chinese government has opposed these restrictions, saying medical experts have deemed them unnecessary. Fiji tourism boss Brent Hill says so far the Fijian government hasn't imposed any additional restrictions on Chinese visitors.
That's a developing sort of situation now that, you know, most countries are looking at that and assessing that. So we'll, from a tourism industry perspective, be really guided by the Ministry of Health.
It's a similar situation in Kiribati, according to Tourism Authority boss Petero Manafalau.
At the moment, there is nothing from our Ministry of Health and Medical Services other than what has been the norm since the 1st of August when we opened, and that's double vaccination and the opportunity to test within 3 days of arrival.
He says that situation could change, but for now, he has one important message for travellers.
Well, certainly make ensure that you're testing negative before you arrive into Kiribati. You know, we're a small remote island destination, quite vulnerable. First and foremost is us seeking travellers to take the utmost responsibility in ensuring that they are protected prior to visiting Kiribati.
That was Kiribati's Tourism Authority CEO, Petero Manafalau, ending that report by Marion Farr with additional reporting by Mackenzie Smith. And as Pacific countries prepare for the return of Chinese tourists to their shores, China is grappling with its largest COVID-19 outbreak yet. To find out more about the situation, we're joined by University of Melbourne's infectious disease epidemiologist, Dr. Fiona Russell. Dr. Russell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Firstly, just how bad is the coronavirus situation in China at the moment?
Yes, look, we're seeing, we don't really know the exact figures, but we're seeing you know, that there is a large explosion of cases that is going on in China at the moment. As we know, China's policy up until recently was one of zero COVID, and so they had lockdowns every time there were cases and strict quarantine and testing requirements. However, with Omicron, as with all countries, have really found it really quite impossible to control. And so that also happened in China. And as such, they've loosened all the and come out of and emerged from zero COVID. And with that, as we've all experienced, you know, all countries that have come out of zero COVID this year, an explosion really of cases. Now, with China, the problem is, though, is that we don't have good data that's coming out of China, so we really don't know the extent of the cases, but that's to some degree understandable because you just can't, because it's so everywhere, you just can't keep up with the cases in a place of a billion people or over a billion people. But also we don't know anything about the severity, you know, in terms of hospitalizations and deaths. But we also will expect a large amount of this because whenever a population meets the virus for the first time, that's when it's the worst. And also the elderly haven't been vaccinated at high levels either, although I understand there is a massive sort of booster and there's other vaccines going around at the moment that they're really aiming to sort of get those booster doses and vaccinations up. And so this will also mean that severity will be worse because they're the highest risk, the elderly, to have of bad outcomes. And the vaccine that they've used as well is slightly less effective than the other vaccines and the ones that have been used in the Pacific as well.
I mean, as you said, Dr. Russell, is it a case that China has pursued the zero COVID policy, so not many people were exposed to the virus, now they are, hence the surge? Or is there another strain or something else going on to contribute to the surge?
Yeah, at the moment, what's happening is that they're going through what we all went through when we came out of zero COVID, and that's the explosion of cases. that happens and ill effects that occur, particularly for those that aren't vaccinated and high risk, when you come out of and meet the virus for the first time. Mm. And so other countries around the world that have met, you know, because waves occur every 3 to 4 months, and that's what we would expect in China as well, this, you know, this massive situation now. And then, like other countries, that once you get your immunity up and the population's immunity up, both through vaccination and immunity derived from infection, those things together then help protect. And so each, for subsequent waves, so each wave ends up becoming less deadly and less severe as time goes on. And so, unfortunately, this is just the nature of this virus. So there is no indication, there is no new variants that have arisen in China at the moment that have been reported or detected anywhere. And so China has uploaded some data on variants into an international database, as all countries do. However, the data is very limited at this point in time. And so it's really important that China, as with all countries, really upload their data in a transparent and sort of timely way so that, you know, all the world knows what's sort of going on and can sort of, prepare themselves accordingly.
Mm. I mean, speaking about that, we just heard from Pacific countries really keen to welcome back Chinese tourists. Of course, this outbreak is happening at a time when China is preparing to open its borders in just 3 days, allowing Chinese tourists to go overseas. Particularly for the Pacific countries, Dr. Russell, does this travel pose any risks?
Well, certainly there's, importations of variants. There's two things, really. It's the importation of a potential of a new variant, and the second thing is the importation, is the, you know, whether there's going to be a burden on the Pacific health system. So we'll take those two things separately. So the first thing is that, you know, there's 7 other billion in the world. So there's 1 billion in China and 7 billion in the rest of the world. And in the rest of the world, we know that there's more than, you know, way more than 100 subvariants and lineages already circulating in around the world. And we don't really have a good handle on all of the subvariants and lineages that are happening in the rest of the world either. You know, some countries haven't uploaded much of this information either. You know, resources and feasibility, of course, are very challenging and in a resource-limited setting. So that's sort of one of the reasons for that. And it's also very less likely, you know, the virologists who sort of, you know, this is their living, studying this kind of thing, also think it's very more less likely that, you know, a strong immune selection to develop variants will occur from China because so little of the population in China has prior immunity. So the variant develops and responds to the immunity in a population at the time. So whatever develops in China will be specific to this situation, which will has used different vaccines and also, you know, the population that has a different, you know, has had no prior immunity. So that's a very different situation from the Pacific, which is by and large, I mean, most countries have got reasonably good and or very high vaccination levels. And also the vast, I think, in fact, all countries now have also been exposed to the virus for the first time, if not two or three times. So, you know, which means that they've got, they're in a better position to be able to handle a new variant that may come in because their population immunity is much higher. Mm. And the European CDC has also said that that they don't think that that travellers from China will pose much of a risk to them because they've already got these variants, as Australia has as well. That, you know, the ones that have been already been detected in China, they've been detected, you know, in many other countries, and also you know, because there's so much infection already occurring in the European Union, the travellers coming from China are unlikely to pose a risk. Now, also, you know, for the Pacific, the people travelling to the Pacific, any traveller, in fact, you know, they're unlikely to be in that high risk group. So that's the variant. So when we come to, is it going to be a burden on the health system? Well, the people who end up in hospital or, you know, or pass away, sadly, are those that are at higher risk. And so those are, by and large, people over 75, particularly those over 80 and 90, and also those that have had on treatment for cancer and, you know, have had a transplant, organ transplant of some kind and things. So they're much likely to, you know, not to be the travellers. So most travellers are under 75 and, you know, don't are otherwise sort of healthy. But in saying that, it's really important responsibility for travellers, like everywhere, is just don't go out and don't travel if you've got symptoms. You know, don't be a responsible citizen and, you know, avoid travelling and avoid, stay at home if you have got symptoms.
Yes, yes. I mean, considering that, countries like Australia have put in place mandatory testing before departure for people in China. Is that something that you think Pacific countries should also implement?
Yeah, look, it's not. Look, I don't think that's going to do anything really. And the European Union has said that, and our own Australian Chief Medical Officer, Professor Paul Kelly, has also given that to our government as the health advice that isn't going to do anything from a public health point of view. And even though, you know, other countries have done it, there's other reasons why they must have done it. So, you know, we know that, you know, a year ago when Omicron first came about, it was detected in South Africa, even though it didn't come from there, but it was because it was detected there. That didn't stop Omicron, from spreading all over the world. So, you know, many countries slapped on travel restrictions to South Africa, and it still spread anyway because it finds other routes. I mean, you know, from what it's just sort of nonsense, really, to think that you can stop the flow from one country when people just travel all over the globe these days. And because this, you know, these new variants are just so highly transmissible, it's a very different situation to what we were in 3 years ago. We've now got vaccines, and as I've said, immunity from being exposed already, that it's in a vastly different situation. And as I say, what we expect to happen in China, there will be an explosion of cases, and as everywhere else, waves every 3 or 4 months. But the most important thing really is to get this genomics data, this variant data, uploaded into the international databases so everybody knows what's going on.
Mm. And Dr. Russell, you mentioned vaccines there. Just finally, I wanted to touch on that. Are the vaccines that we took perhaps a year ago still effective for us in the Pacific? And what about China's vaccination programs? I know they've had a different one. Is that effective for the travellers who might have taken that and now travelling into the Pacific?
Yeah, so boosters are really critical. So it's important to keep up to date with your booster. So if you haven't had your booster, and I know in all countries that's been offered, it's really important, particularly for people over 50, healthcare workers and pregnant women. So just make sure that's the most important thing to prepare and forevermore is. And so, yes, they're highly effective. They don't, the protection that they give against infection, you know, to get symptoms is limited, or, you know, it lasts for a few weeks and then fades away, really, it wanes. But the protection against severe disease and, you know, dying or ending up in hospital is still high. I mean, it's not 100%, but it's still very high. But it's just make sure you keep up to date with your vaccination as recommended by the government. And then the ones that are being used in China are the inactivated vaccines, the locally made ones, and they are that great against infection, and never were really, but they are still very good against severe disease and death. A bit less so than the ones used in the Pacific, but still very, very good.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Dr. Russell, thank you for your time this morning on Pacific Beat.
Okay, a pleasure. Thanks, Priyanka.
That was Dr. Fiona Russell, University of Melbourne's infectious disease epidemiologist, speaking to us about the prospect of Chinese tourists returning to the Pacific and what that might mean for COVID-19 in the region. You're listening to Pacific Beat. Hope you're having a lovely Thursday morning. Now, the key question that has been on many Fijians' minds as the new Rumbuka government takes office is how would the opposition under Frank Bainimarama and his right-hand man, Ayaz Sayed Kayum, react? Well, over the last week, we've gotten some insight into that. The former Prime Minister has blasted the sitting government in several public addresses, most recently accusing it of oppressive conduct. Here he is during an early address on Tuesday night.
There is no doubt that Rumbuka is hell-bent on appointing his political cronies, unsuccessful candidates, and those who will not be independent. He does not want to appoint smart, capable, savvy, appropriately qualified, credible, independent professionals.
Since that address on Tuesday, Mr. Bainimarama has walked back an attempt to put Mr. Sayed Kayum on a commission overseeing the constitution, which would have meant that the former Attorney General would have lost his seat in Parliament. To take us through all these twists and turns in Fiji's politics, we're joined by Lide Muvono. Yandra Lide.
Yandra Vinaka Priyanka.
Now, let's go through this latest here, Lide. The leader of the opposition, Mr. Bainimarama, has produced this incredible statement last night on his social media account. He's alleged a deteriorating situation in Fiji. Now, Lide, you're in Fiji's capital, Suva, right now. What exactly are you seeing? Is there any evidence of Mr. Bainimarama's claims?
Priyanka, I'm afraid Fiji is quite normal for this time of the year. In fact, a little bit more festive than usual. Just yesterday and the day before that, our Fiji police force sent their bands, their musical bands, out into the streets of Suva, in some of the more difficult neighborhoods in terms of lower income and in terms of poverty. Just sending them out, you know, to play on the streets and basically, for want of a better description, party with the people. You know, it's obviously a public relations exercise, but one that was so well received by Fijians who were getting into the New Year festivities, throwing water at these police officers, putting powder and flour on them, which is a little, you know, local tradition. So I'm afraid there isn't very much evidence, if at all, of the deteriorating situation that Frank Bainimarama, the leader of the opposition, spoke about in his latest statement last night.
Interesting that contrast there. I mean, the statements that Mr. Bainimarama made yesterday follow another extraordinary statement that he made earlier in the week. Now, he wanted to nominate Ayaz Sayed Kayum to this Constitutional Officers Commission, the COC, that would in effect force him to resign as MP because you can't hold both positions. Many call that quite a bizarre move, and I understand that he's since taken it back. Can you sort of take us through? Was that a accurate summary of what happened, and why this backflip on that decision?
Well, look, to understand what's happening now is to look back at the early days of this new coalition government. Once they came in, they started to look at those very senior members of the executive government who were very close to the previous government and who were vocal about that, the intimacy of that relationship. And so it began with the defense minister, Pierre Tikundundua, calling on the police commissioner, Sitiveni Ngiliho, to resign. Now, Sitiveni Ngiliho is a military man appointed to the position of a police commissioner in Fiji First Party's leadership. And he's very well known in the military, having been part of Frank Bainimarama's takeover in 2006. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, Ngiliho refused the invitation to resign and said he preferred to use the normal processes of the Constitutional Officers Commission. So the COC appoints several of our very high-level government positions, the police commissioner being one, the commissioner of prisons being another, and it's interesting to note the commissioner of prisons is, of course, brother-in-law to Frank Bainimarama. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, latest turn of events, while a surprise to very many lay people, is not to those who are watching local politics. It is what is to be expected. The government coming in Rumbuka's words, say, you know, one people they can work closely with, who hasn't worked closely with the previous government. And so that process could only have been made slower if the Constitutional Officers Commission, had people who were loyal to the Fiji First Party. And so who better to fill that opposition, then the General Secretary of the Fiji First Party itself, Ayaz Said Kayum, who, it must be noted, is the second highest ranking parliamentarian elected into this new House of Representatives. He's extremely popular, one of the few to have, you know, received an increase to his voter base in these elections. Everyone else has struggled to get the votes, and so he's extremely popular. And while also an extremely contentious figure, people expected him to be, you know, firebrand in this new parliament. So one can't be sure if it was a lack of foresight on the part of the leader of opposition, but in moving that he be the opposition the opposition's nominee to the COC, which they're required by the constitution to do, he nominated him, and then that was immediately formalized by the president, Ratu William Katuniveri, who of course is a president elected appointed to the position in the previous government's leadership. So once that happened, and Ayaz actually attended via Zoom, because he's still there in Australia, by the way. Once he attended that meeting, he effectively became a member of the COC and vacated his position in Parliament. The current constitution, which we were reminded of by the Supervisor of Elections, Mohamed Sanim, yesterday as well, members of political parties, particularly, you know, and especially executive members, people who hold positions such as a general secretary, cannot be members of the COC and vice versa. So once he attended that meeting along with Frank Bainimarama 2 days ago now, he vacated his parliament seat. And so, you know, effectively losing his the next seat to the leader of opposition in parliament. And so it really can't be confirmed, mostly because we're not getting through to the Fiji First Party. We're still being ignored. Most journalists, all journalists are still being ignored by Frank Bainimarama and the opposition party. So we don't really know what it was, you know, whether you know, they just didn't realize these amendments that had been made to the Public Office Holder Act, or if they you know, they understood that that was a consequence. But Ayaz Said Kayum is now no longer a member of Parliament, and he now is no longer a member of the Constitutional Offices Commission either, as per the latest statement by Frank Bainimarama.
Oh, so, interesting. So I guess they've lost both. Yes, yes. So they've lost both. I just assumed he'd return to his parliamentary seat, but that's not guaranteed.
And it's not. I mean, I think I spent all night, well, a good part of last night trying to look at the constitution to see if there's, you know, if there's provision for someone that's vacated his seat by his own acceptance of another position can, you know, can just go back. As far as I know, you lose your seat in parliament. The seat now goes to the next person in your party with the next, you know, number of votes. And that put, so far, there is someone who has been identified who garnered 590 votes in the election. So that person is effectively the next member of parliament for Fiji First and should be getting sworn in soon. So this latest statement by Bainimarama is where he speaks of a deteriorating situation that we have not heard from the Fiji police force and that we're not seeing on the ground is strange, I think, to put it mildly, Priyanka.
Yes, very interesting stuff. I mean, we did speak to Professor John Frankel on yesterday's afternoon show in Lille. He said that this shows a lack of strategy for the opposition. And also, I mean, there are these concerns that these back and forth, these statements between the opposition attacking government have fears considering Fiji's history of military intervention as well. Are those fears well-founded, do you believe, Lide? Are there fears that such a thing might happen again?
Well, look, you know, on the streets, I mean, we're talking to people, and yesterday I did, last night after Frank Manorama's latest statement, I did call CSOs and NGOs, and one of the biggest local ones is, of course, the Fiji Council of Social Services, which has 18 district council of social services. So these are community workers who have other jobs and other positions, but who do community work on the very absolute grassroots, and who feed back into the national pulse, so to speak, you know, telling us what's happening on the ground in terms of poverty, in terms of movement, in terms of what people are crying out for. And they're saying that, you know, there's no evidence on the ground of any racial disharmony, but that people anxious. With every statement that comes out, there's some anxiety. For those of us who are old enough, you know, to know what led up to the 2006 takeover of government by Frank Bainimarama, this is deja vu almost. We were getting, you know, daily statements speaking to a situation that the rest of us weren't seeing. And by the end of a few weeks, we had a new government. And so there's some anxiety around what he's saying, and there's some anxiety around, you know, whether or not he still has the loyalty within the Republican military forces to be able to execute some sort of a takeover. But we do know that the military has said several times over this election period that they're staying out of the political and the election processes. So, yes, there's some anxiety, but whether or not it's causing the kind of fear that comes with disruptions or political upheavals is the question I have to figure out answers to today, Priyanka.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Lide, bringing us those latest updates. We keep on thinking we can breathe a sigh that Fiji politics is not going to surprise us, but it continues to. So thank you for bringing us the latest there, Lide.
Too much more exciting than we bargained for.
Indeed. Thank you. That was Lide Muvono there in Fiji, as I said, bringing us all those twists and turns from Fiji politics. And as Lide mentioned, we have reached out to Fiji First membership and Mr. Bainimarama himself to come on the show. We still haven't heard a response.
Love sport? Tune in to Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau.
But, like, you know, rugby union, like, they reset the scrum so often. Like,
here we go.
It's a bit of a time waster. Like, we just get ours done and move on.
Yeah, but see, like, your play is, like, no different to just a tap and go.
We're trying to compare it. Let's stop trying to one-up each other.
Yeah, we're going to end up in a fight soon.
Can You Be More Pacific? Fridays from 2 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. My name is Priyanka Srinivasan. Many families leaving their loved ones' dead bodies in hospital is the main source of morgue overcrowding in Papua New Guinea's biggest hospital, authorities say. The issue came to light in a viral video on social media, which showed dead bodies dumped in a makeshift facility without air conditioning. Reporter Belinda Cora spoke with the Port Moresby General Hospital acting CEO Connie Sobey about the worrying situation.
It is challenging. You know, we've got the huge task and challenge ahead of us in terms of providing level-based clinical service to the community, to the population. And they have their costs. And at the same time, we are now challenged with the fact that we have to deal with the dead bodies, the cops that are brought into the hospital morgue system. More than half of these bodies that are admitted to the morgue are deaths that are occurring in the community, in the population that is within the city and in the close neighboring fringes of the city. You know, some of these bodies eventually become unclaimed by relatives for whatever reason, and they end up accumulating and causing this strain on the very limited capacity we have at the morgue. Remember, the morgue was built in 1990 for a capacity of 64. But at the moment, we have about 300 bodies in our morgue system. Over the years, we were adding, you know, one container and so forth. But in the last 12 months, we've actually added two more 20-foot containers, refrigerated containers, to increase the capacity. But the population of the city has also expanded, and that is putting a huge pressure. And then when we have the proportion of unclaimed bodies that are accumulating for months, it just puts more pressure on the capacity we have at the moment.
This isn't the first mass burial that the hospital has had to process and also carry out. When do you think something can be done to ensure the morgue is given the attention it needs at this time?
Yeah, so, I mean, the immediate actions that what we've been doing over the last few years to do a timely mass burial, especially for the unclaimed, because unless we can claim everybody, you know, every relative can claim their deceased loved ones, I don't think we will come to this stage where we are inundated with bodies and the capacity we have for the bodies. Putting on additional container, which we are planning to put in, this will be our sixth container if we put it in the next 1 month. We just need to continue do maybe 3 or 4 mass burials every year. In that way, we aim to ensure that there is one container that is always on standby, so that if one breaks down, we can move bodies from the broken down container to the one that's always on standby. In that way, we don't have bodies that are piling up in the layout room and causing all these media attraction, social media attraction, and so forth.
Doctor, are you able to tell us how much do families in the city and also outside of Port Moresby pay to keep their loved ones at the hospital for a day? Is this part of the reason why families are finding it difficult to again return for their loved ones, or are there other factors that you may be able to tell us more about?
Yeah, so if you look at the unclaimed bodies, I mean the bodies that have been there for months, we do put out advertisements on our daily Post Courier or National for relatives of the deceased ones to come and pick up the bodies of their deceased loved ones. There are a few that come and pick up after the advertisement goes out in the papers. But there's still a lot, majority. Roughly, if we put out, say, you know, maybe 100 names of 100 deceased persons in the morgue, we'll have about 20 coming forward and saying, okay, listen, one of that body is ours. We are going to come and take the body away. So you see, still up to 80% of them will be unclaimed. And these are the ones that have been there. So we put out the advertisement. We give people like 3 months, and then after that, we put the notice out. So bodies would have been there already for 3 months or more, and then we put out the notices. So if they don't come after the 2 weeks grace period, we then get the warrants of burial from the coroner. So the reasons, you know, it could be cost to get the bodies from, you know, they could be from remote parts of the country, you know, and it's just too costly for the relatives to repatriate the bodies. That's one possible reason for not coming forward to claim the bodies, and so that, you know, it's just like left alone in the morgue. Because we are charging the families, you know, first week is free, we don't charge, and then after that, it's a daily charge of 10 kina. But even then, we do not deny anyone coming to get their bodies, you know, after months in the hospital, and then, you know, they may have accumulated 500 or 600 or even 1,000. We don't hold back anyone just because they can't afford to pay that. We just release the bodies.
Going forward, citizens who had seen that video on Monday are now calling for action to be taken by those in authority. Is the health minister being made aware of the situation, and what has NCDC said, and is there funds available by the hospital to do something in assisting also in fixing up the morgue?
Like I said, this is not a new thing. So we have in the past this with relevant authorities, including the department, national department, and I'm pretty sure the minister is well aware of this situation. We have also been in discussion with the city authority and CDC and then other stakeholders. You know, we are grateful for stakeholders who have come forward in the last 18 months or so, you know, during the COVID coronavirus outbreak in the city with the addition of 2 20-foot containers. We are now planning to put another 20-foot container so that we will have one container that is on standby so that when one breaks down, we are putting more than, you know, what it is capable, its capacity is. And so there's frequent breakdown. And so the frequent breakdown means, you know, we have to get contractors to come and repair those cooling systems, and it's coming at a cost.
That was Dr. Connie Isobi speaking there with Belinda Cora. You're listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Muddy water, a peppery drink, or an exotic sleeping aid, kava has been marketed in all sorts of ways to foreign markets and foreign palates. But as the export market grows in the Pacific, is there a key to cracking the industry? Consultant Tanu Uvasa, Semi Siakimotu, has been helping kava growers in Vanuatu, Samoa, Fiji and Solomon Islands meet Australian demands. He joins us now. Very good morning to you, Semi.
Good morning, Bianca. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Now, I understand that you are a consultant for kava. Now, kava is fairly new to the Australian market, at least. Can you tell us how is it looking right now in Australia? I understand that they just recently opened their borders to kava. Who exactly is buying it? Who's selling kava? Is the market growing? Can you tell us the ins and outs?
Yeah, thank you, Priyanka. And if you don't mind, before we start or before I start, I'd like to begin today by giving thanks to our Heavenly Father for this, for His guidance and blessings upon us all. And I also want to wish your listeners a happy and kava-filled 2023. And I also want to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which I am joining this interview today, and pay my respects to the elders past and present, and extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be listening to this broadcast as well. So in terms of your question around the Australian market and in relation to kava and who's consuming kava in the Australian context, it's mainly our Pacific Island communities. It's been a welcome support with the Australian market opening up, thereby allowing our people to gain access to kava from our Pacific Island countries. But most of the kava coming in is actually being consumed by our Pacific Island communities. So it's...
And is there a desire to expand that and get, I guess, other people who may not be Pacific Islander also drinking kava?
Yeah, it's an area that we as a collective, and when I say we, I'm talking about various organisations that are providing support to the kava stakeholders in the region. Mm. It's an area where we all need to work on and understand how we can work with those markets, because at this point the focus has been a lot on the production and supply of kava to the markets, including Australia. But we haven't really worked closely on the market side to understand what they really want and how they want it. So I think for the Australia market, we will rely on our stakeholders in Australia, the Pacific Island communities, and then relevant groups to champion that. Because we need, for the stakeholders in the Pacific Island countries to benefit from this market opportunity in Australia and other countries, really, we need other consumers to join and experience the benefits of kava and enjoy the benefits of kava.
Mm. Oh, yes. It's very interesting also contrasting, I guess, the different groups, because as you said, in Australia, I guess it's mainly Pacific Islanders consuming kava. But in somewhere like United States, which I understand has been importing kava for quite some time, I remember being there and seeing, I don't know if you've heard about these, Semi, but these kava bars that exist where you can, you know, take down a shell of kava alongside your beer. Is that part of your job now, I guess, perhaps to look at the potential of similar markets opening up elsewhere?
I mean, we can't turn a blind eye, and I totally agree. You know, the example in the US is pretty much a commercial recognition of how we drink kava in places like Vanuatu, where we have Nakamals. It's a local version of a kava bar. And so in the US, you know, they've got, I think, around over 300 kava bars now, and the way they drink kava, it's about what the consumer wants. So they mix it with other fruit juices or other drinks, and not alcohol. I want to clarify that it's not kava is not being mixed with alcohol in those kava bars.
Mm.
But it's the way for us to grow this market. We need to understand how we can introduce or introduce kava to those consumers, because as you know, I think I wanted to touch on the point you made in your introduction around the muddy water or muddy drink. And we really want to stay away from that kind of terminology, because it's not. I've been asked that question as well. You know, what does it taste like? You know, this kava that I've been told it tastes like mud. And for me, I haven't tasted mud, so I don't know what it tastes like. And I'm sure no one has drank or likes to drink muddy water. So we need to stay away from that kind of terminology. And to introduce new people to kava, there are those who like to drink it the traditional way. Mm. There are those who also want to take it in the encapsulated form. And so, but there's also quite a large number of people who are stuck in the middle. They want to try, but they don't want to take the capsule, or they don't want to drink it in its traditional form. So could we look at something that would appeal to them and so they can still enjoy the effects of kava?
Yes, very interesting. I guess, yes, muddy water is not the most appealing of thoughts when you think about kava, but indeed, there are other things that kava can provide. And is there a bit of, you know, sort of trying to teach people about Pacific culture and Pacific Islander links when it comes to the drink as well? I don't know if you saw this recent video that was circulating online, Semi, about our former Deputy Prime Minister McCormack drinking kava. I believe he was in Micronesia somewhere and falling quite terribly ill because he was trying to, I guess, keep up with what he perceived to be cultural expectations. Have you seen that video about with McCormack falling ill after drinking kava? And do you have any thoughts about what that does to the reputation of the drink?
Yeah, I've seen the video. And my hat off to the former Deputy PM. He was trying to, I guess, do what he's observed in other parts of the Pacific where kava is consumed, and you know it, certainly in the context of Tonga, Fiji, Samoa, and Vanuatu, you don't sip on kava. You drink the whole shell in one go. In the context of Northern Pacific, which is where this video was taken, you sip the kava because it's quite strong, and everyone takes a sip at a time. Whereas in the case of the former Deputy PM, he drank the whole thing in one go, and that's quite potent in itself. I don't think it gives a bad image of kava. I think it's just something that we can learn from, because on our side we need to educate new people who are wanting to enjoy kava and experience what kava is. On the consumer side, they also need to, I guess, ask the question, and those who are surrounding them to also give the right advice and counsel to make sure that the experience is one that they can remember for the right reasons. I think it's a... it was quite an interesting video, and one that has done the rounds already on the on.
Yes, it's done the rounds, but you're so right. I guess that education about the culture and the different cultures in the Pacific when it comes to kava is so important. I mean, that's the consumption side, the foreign consumption side of kava. But looking at the other side, you've been speaking to stakeholders there in the Pacific. What have they been sharing with you? Do they want to crack this foreign market when it comes to kava?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, the interesting thing with kava is that only a small part of the industry is represented by exports, but still it's an important one for the stakeholders in the country, in the Pacific Island countries, because they see exports as an opportunity for when the market in the Pacific Island countries it gets overloaded with a lot of kava. At least there's an outlet where they can export and get some of that economic benefit for their families. So there is that strong desire to open the market and export more kava to those markets. The challenge, of course, is as I think I met with one of your colleagues in the Solomon Islands, is that and that's why the focus of the country is around developing a standardized approach to make sure that the quality is well understood across the sector.
So those have been
some of the investment of the stakeholders in the countries to make sure that those opportunities remain open to the kava sector.
Going into the future and to see where it goes. That colleague you mentioned is Chris and Rita Amanu Leong, who did a very interesting story about that quality standards when it comes to kava. Semi, you've got your work cut out, I guess, ahead of you, opening up these kava markets. But thank you so much for joining our show this morning on Pacific Beat to tell us all about it.
You're most welcome. Most welcome. Thank you for the opportunity to talk kava.
Thank you. That was consultant Tanu Ovasa, Semi Siakimotu, talking to us about kava and how we can crack these foreign markets as the industry does open up to other countries. And with that, it brings us to the end of Pacific Beat for this Thursday morning. You won't hear my voice for quite some time because I'm taking a couple of weeks off from Pacific Beat, from ABC for some time. You'll be in the trusted hands of Kyle Evans, I believe, next week, and Nick Fogarty, very familiar voices here on Pacific Beat there. But while I'm away, wishing you a very lovely rest of your New Year's celebrations, if you do have them ahead of you. I hope you have a lovely day today.